This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My first guest is Issa Rae. You can get a sense of her self-image from the titles of her best-known works. Her new HBO series is called Insecure. The web comedy series and memoir that preceded it were both titled The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. They're all about issues of identity and feelings of not fitting in, things Issa Rae dealt with all the time when she was growing up. She was one of the few black kids in her school in Maryland, but when her family moved to South LA, she wasn't considered black enough. She has also lived in Senegal, where her father is from, where she was the only American in her school. Rae co-created HBO's Insecure with Larry Wilmore, and she stars in it as a 29-year-old woman whose life seems to have stalled. She lives with her boyfriend, but isn't sure the relationship has a future, and her job isn't fulfilling her creative impulses. She works as the youth liaison at a nonprofit called We Gotcha All, which works with predominantly African-American schools, offering students mentoring programs, after-school tutoring, standardized test coaching, and other things to try to supplement what the students haven't been getting in school. Here's a scene from episode one in which she's talking to a class of junior high students.
As youth liaison, I can assure you that whatever it is you need to succeed, we got you. So do y'all have any questions? Don't be shy, guys. Fire away.
Why you talk like a white girl?
You caught me. I'm rocking blackface. Any other questions?
What's up with your hair?
I don't know what you mean.
My cousin can put some tracks in it. Unless you like it like that.
You rule. She African.
We're all from Africa, guys.
Absolutely. Let's stick to questions about the program.
Is this what you always want to do?
No. But I got this job after college, and it fit my interests at the time.
Are you single?
I don't think that's appropriate.
Yes, you're single.
Since you guys are so interested in my personal life, here it is. I'm 28, actually 29, because today's my birthday. I came from a great family. I have a college degree. I work in the nonprofit world because I like to give back. I've been with my boyfriend for 5 years, and I did this to my hair on purpose. So I hope that covers everything. Does anybody actually have any questions about We Got Y'all?
Why ain't you married?
I'm just not, right now.
My dad said, ain't nobody checking for bitter-ass black women anymore.
Denise, that's detention. Apologize now.
Sorry.
That's okay. And tell your dad that black women aren't bitter. They're just tired of being expected to settle for less.
Her outfit settled for less.
That's Issa Rae from the first episode of her series Insecure. Issa Rae, I love the series. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much, Terry.
So the things that your character is mocked for by the junior high school kids, where do those lines come from? Did kids in junior high say that to you?
Yes. Pretty much everything aside from the why aren't you married part, I've been asked. Actually, in my adult life, I've been asked, why are you married? What am I talking about? But all of those questions those kids ask, I've been asked at some point in time. So that was all truth, and just wanted to have her face all of those questions at once in a very irritating way.
Just another thing I really love about that scene is that you're being insulted for things you're proud of. You know, your hair, the way you speak. And you're being insulted by children, a big group of them, and they're kind of like ganging up on you. Have you ever been in that position? I mean, I have when I taught briefly. It was just really awful to supposed to be the adult in the room and, like, the kids are just, like, mocking you and...
Kids are so good at that, though. They're so witty, and especially at that age. They're, like, 11 or 12, so it feels like their sense of humor is just getting honed, and it kind of gets mean to that point. Like, they're trying to one-up one another to be the funniest, and I, even in my adult life, like, if I see a group of kids, you know, having a conversation, having a good time, I will cross the street because, like, at that time, they're just so mean and so funny at the same time. Like, I think about so many of the things that kids made fun of me for and the insults they had. And in hindsight, I'm just like, they were funny. They were really, really funny kids, but it hurt my feelings.
So let's hear a scene at work. So this is from the start of the series where you're describing the nonprofit that you work at, which is called We Got Y'all. And you're talking about the organization, and as you're doing this kind of voiceover thing, we see images of where you work, and we see your white boss wearing a dashiki. The office is full of posters of Martin Luther King and Beyonce, and a photo of the boss with President Obama. And at the end of this voiceover, it cuts to you, and you're in front of a mirror, and you're rapping in front of the mirror. In this series, this is the equivalent sometimes of your voiceover narrative. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like you're talking to yourself, but you're doing it in rap. So that's how this scene ends, but it starts with a voiceover.
My boss founded a nonprofit to help kids from the hood, but she didn't hire anybody from the hood.
I'm torn between the Booker T method and the Du Bois method. What would James Baldwin say is most beneficial for people of color?
In 2016?
I've been here 5 years and they think I'm the token with all the answers.
It's just us, Issa. Issa, what's on fleek?
I don't know what that means.
I know what that means. But being aggressively passive is what I do best. I used to keep a journal to vent. Now I just write raps.
Go, shawty. It's my birthday. But no one cares because I'm not having a party. Because I'm feeling sorry for myself.
Okay, and you rap much better than that later. Later in the series.
Do I?
Yes. In my opinion, yes. So part of the series is about, you know, being the person who you think is like the token black person at work. And right. Your best friend is the only African-American in the law firm where she works. She's a lawyer. So being an artist, like you're working on TV shows and this is like your own show. It's like your creation. Did you work in a nonprofit where you felt similar to how your character does?
Absolutely. I've worked in a couple of nonprofit settings. I've worked in briefly in the corporate world and have definitely been the sole person of color, the sole black person. And for me, with this organization in the series, We Got Y'all, I really wanted to just depict my nightmare nonprofit organization. I found the world of nonprofits funny to begin with, just because having worked there, you see that people are so altruistic and they're so benevolent and they're pretty selfless and you're working generally for a great cause. But the atmosphere within the work environment can be oddly competitive. People want the credit. Sometimes they don't listen to the people they're trying to help. And for me, this white guilt is so prevalent at this nonprofit. And they treat the kids as this pity party. And for me, I would hate to work in an environment like this, but it's ripe for comedy.
And your character's in the position of having like a great Kenyan leader quoted to her by a white person. The white person is sitting down, your character saying like, you got to work harder. You don't seem to be invested in the work anymore. And she says, you know, if you're not invested in the work, maybe this isn't the place for you. And then she quotes this great Kenyan leader as saying, the leader who doesn't take advice is not a leader. And your character's kind of rolling her eyes that, you know, she's getting this Kenyan quote quoted back at her. Is that something that you've experienced and that bothers you when it happens?
No one's quoted a Kenyan proverb to me, thankfully. But I have had, you know, people. And in this scene, it's kind of hard because the boss isn't wrong. Like, you know, Issa has not been putting herself out there. And I have been called out for just not being present. And that's been correct, you know. So I was working at jobs that I knew that I didn't want to be at long term because I wanted to pursue my dreams. But and then conversely, I have had, you know, white people kind of try to take my black card in a sense and use examples of mainstream blackness, quote unquote, and use me as a reference for why I don't act black. And that's been extremely frustrating.
So there's a lot of code switching that happens in Insecure. And your character even is practicing different ways of speaking and being in rehearsing options that she can say to her ex-boyfriend when she meets him for the first time in several years. And she's in front of the mirror putting on different shades of lipstick. And with each shade of lipstick she puts on, she talks differently. And then after doing this for a long time, she finally just puts on lip balm. To me, the lip balm means like, not like, I am proud of who I am and I'm just going to be myself. It's more like, I'm resigned to who I am and I have no choice but to be myself.
Yep, that's it. It's the easiest to be myself at this point.
So can you talk about some of the different ways of speaking that your character is trying on to rehearse approaching her ex-boyfriend?
Well, in that particular scene, she's already made a declaration that she wants to be kind of, she wants to go after what she wants. And these lipsticks allow her to try on literally different personalities and to try to be the fun one, the aggressive one, the exotic, you know, dainty one. And, you know, at the end of the day, she realizes, okay, I'm not good at being any of these people and I just might as well be myself. And she has a lot of those moments in the bathroom in particular. I think the bathroom is definitely her safe space and the space where she can actually be vulnerable and express herself in an extremely honest way. It's the only place that she is actually honest with herself and expresses her thoughts in a way that she can't in the outside world because she's a self-described aggressively passive person. So you'll see a lot of those mirror moments where she's kind of forced to face her truth and herself at the end of the day.
So it seems to me you have a very complicated relationship with rap, starting with when you moved to South LA after having grown up in Maryland and having gone to a predominantly white but multicultural, but you know, but kind of diverse school in Potomac, Maryland. You had also lived for a while in Senegal. Your father's from Senegal. So when you moved to South LA, what did rap mean to the students in your school there? And how much did you know about the music when you moved there?
I only knew what my older brothers, so I have two older brothers, and they were super into hip hop, rap, and they would try to introduce me to artists. But I was more into R&B and just pop music in general. And I was young, and my mom shielded me specifically and my younger siblings from like explicit lyrics and explicit music in general. So they could introduce me, but I didn't really pay attention. And so by the time I moved to LA, I was great. I was really well versed in R&B. Like, nobody could touch me there, but I wasn't as into rap as a lot of the other students. And I remember the year that I started sixth grade, Tupac died. And I didn't know much about him. And obviously, Tupac and L.A. go hand in hand to a degree. Like, L.A. claims Tupac really hard. And I didn't know him. So when everyone was devastated that he died, you know, I wanted to be part of the conversation and had only read his name and hadn't heard it. And so I came up to a bunch of classmates who already did not like me already and was just like, oh, my God, I heard that Tupac died. You know, what did he sing? And was just shunned for the rest of the quarter.
So let me ask you about the web title, Awkward Black Girl. That's how you saw yourself for a long time. Where did the awkward part come in, which I imagine is the same kind of part that your series takes its name from, Insecure?
Yeah, well, I was sitting on my bed in New York one day and just thinking about having a reflective moment and trying to figure out what I wanted to do and what my issues were, and just was writing in my notebook and wrote down the phrase, I'm awkward, period, and black. And that was just a revelatory moment for me in so many ways. Like, I knew I was black, obviously, but the awkward part really just defined me in a sense. Like, it defined why I was always, like, socially uncomfortable. It defined my introvert status. It defined, like, why I didn't fit into mainstream media's definition of blackness. And I just thought that that felt like an identity that I had not seen reflected in television or film before, or at least in a very long time.
So what made you think that the parts of your life that made you feel awkward and insecure, you could claim as an identity and then use that to your advantage and create a character who would be kind of like funny and relatable and everything, So you could turn what you perceived as like your weakness into a strength.
Well, for me, it came from watching shows like Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, and even 30 Rock, and just identifying with a very specific sense of humor that those shows had, but also being like, wow, there are no people of color in these shows that have the same sense of humor, you know? And wondering, like, why is there this segregated humor? There seems to be, like, black humor, and there seems to be white humor. And, you know, a lot of my friends' tastes, you know, we like both, but we don't get to see ourselves reflected on the quote-unquote white humor side. And so I wanted to take these traits in the same way that, you know, a lot of my favorite comedians have done it, and Ellen included. Ellen takes so many relatable, embarrassing moments and amplifies them and makes it like, oh, my God, I've been through that, too, and that's so funny. And have a black character go through those things and make it very racially specific but universal at the same time.
So you were born in L.A., but you also grew up in Potomac, Maryland, and then moved back to L.A. Was that a bit of a culture shock from Maryland?
It was, just because I was watching a lot of television. So I watched shows like Saved by the Bell. Even though that wasn't set in L.A., I just thought that would be my L.A. experience. And 90210.
That's hilarious.
And just was excited to be able to go to junior high and have lockers. Like, there was just something sexy and alluring about lockers to me. And there was a culture shock in that way, that I was not the popular girl, that no one cared that I came from Maryland, that I was just not, you know, people always said that I talked like a white girl, and my hair did not have the positive traits it had for being natural like it did when I was in Maryland. And I was just like, out of place. And, you know, I think part of that was also that I was a nerd, too. But I just remember thinking, like, whoa, I do not fit in. And I wonder why that is. And it's a period of time that I always reference in my work, I find.
Did your parents help you through that at all? Did they have any helpful advice or reassurance?
Well, my dad, just being African, was like, deal with it. Like, stop crying. And my mom, she tried to get it, but she was, her thing was just always about embracing it. And nobody wants to hear that. Like, no, I think being a teen and being a preteen is all about, like, fitting in and not standing out. And everything that she told me to do would cause me to stand out. Like, embrace your hair. And, you know, if they're talking about the way that you're talking, then just say, I'm smart. That's why, you know, or I'm speaking English correctly. And it's like, Mom, no, nobody wants to. I'm not trying to feel superior. I want people to like me.
What was your father's attitude to the whole American thing about what it means to be black, and are you black enough, and are you authentic, and all that? Because coming from Africa, I'm not sure whether all of that would have made any sense to him.
It didn't, and he didn't really subscribe to those notions. I mean, he understood that there were obstacles that black people faced, but in his mind, those are obstacles that you can overcome just by working hard and by doing the right thing. And we've never really had conversations about race, just because, you know, while he acknowledges a lot of the burdens, he's also like his own success story. You know, he came from a family of, you know, 7 kids, the oldest, and came from Dakar, Senegal, and is a successful doctor here. And so he's just like very much about working hard. And in some ways, I realize that in not having those discussions with him and just seeing what he's done, I've been able to kind of do that on my end too. Like, I do refuse to see obstacles to a degree. And, you know, I acknowledge that they exist, but I refuse to kind of let them affect me. And I guess I'm just realizing that about him.
So you lived for, I think, 2 periods of your life in Senegal?
Just 1 period in my life.
And the other time was just for a visit?
Visiting. So I used to go back, like, every summer.
So how did...
I'm overstating that. Sorry.
Lots of summers.
Yes, lots of summers.
So in terms of, like, fitting in versus feeling awkward, how did you register those feelings in Senegal? Where did you fit on the scale?
It's so interesting because my Americanness brought me some street cred in a way, just because pop culturally, a lot of my cousins, I had a lot of cousins out there. And I remember going there for the summer. Everyone would gather at like 4 o'clock to watch Alec au Malibu, which was like Baywatch. And that was like the show to watch. And then 90210 would come on right afterwards. And I remember them asking me like, wow, you're from LA. Do you see Donna? Do you see Dylan just on the street? And I'd be like, yeah, dude, you know, I was just at Kelly's house last week. And they bought it. And that, like, my Americanness for the pop cultural side was valued in a way and made me cool.
When you were getting started and starting to get serious about, you know, writing and acting, your apartment was broken into, and your laptops, your videos, your cameras, all your work was basically stolen. You hadn't backed up. Mm-hmm. Shame on you. Did you interpret a hidden message with that, like the gods were telling you, just like, give up, or that the gods were telling you, start a different project? Or, you know what I mean? Sometimes something happens, yes, to you, and you figure, like, there's a secret message here. What does it mean?
That's such a good point, actually. So I was in New York when that happened, and I was struggling. And, well, the start a different project aspect that you just said is so interesting, just because that's the advice that I always give to up-and-coming creatives, because I have seen people constantly try to peddle the same project over the course of years. And it's like, you should have multiple projects going on. And I think I was in a state where I was trying to peddle the same project and trying to get it to television. And I actually, the day after the robbery, I was supposed to have a meeting. Like, the day before, I was supposed to have this major meeting to try to take this project to television is when my apartment got robbed, and I lost all of the materials that I didn't back up. Thanks, Terry. But that was a great, for me, a great sign that, one, I shouldn't be in New York. Like, I was willingly struggling, and I stayed there an extra year after that, despite knowing that, and that I needed to try other projects. And that next year is when I came up with the idea for Awkward Black Girl, but didn't necessarily pursue it because I felt like I was too broke, but just started writing more. And also that next year, I also decided to move back to LA, where I knew people and I had more resources and could rely on people to actually help me get my projects done.
So I listen to a lot of voices hosting this show, and you, I love your voice. You have a beautiful voice.
What?
It's so like deep and resonant. And so when you were how old were you when it started to get that kind of, you know, depth, that resonance? You didn't have that in high school, did you?
I don't know. I do not know. It's so funny. This generation, I was saying, we're so used to seeing ourselves and listening to ourselves now that it's just not a big deal. But I remember being like hearing my voice on a voicemail and being like, ugh, stop it, make it stop. And, you know, now I just don't even think about it. So I've always thought I had a deep voice since high school, middle school, but I have no idea. But thank you.
It's interesting because your voice conveys a certain confidence that you say that you've lacked in real life.
That's very helpful. Well, that might be why people don't think that. I mean, people are always like, oh, it's so funny that you say that you're awkward because you're not. And I'm like, because I fooled you. But I don't see the same. I don't see what they see.
Issa Rae, it's been great to talk with you. Congratulations on your series.
Terry, it's been an honor. Thank you so, so much.
Issa Rae is the co-creator and star of the HBO comedy series Insecure. Filmmaker Kelly Reichert has been described in the New York Times as making feminist westerns. In her new film, Certain Women, she looks at the intersecting lives of several Montana women, played by Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, Kristen Stewart, and Lily Gladstone. Our critic at large, John Powers, has this review.
I once took a trip up the Amazon, and the boat went so slowly that for the first several hours, all I noticed was my own boredom. But gradually, my inner clock began slowing down. And as I gave myself over to river time, I began to take in the wonders around me. I saw pink freshwater dolphins leaping out of the corner of my eye. You might find yourself having a similar experience watching the films of Kelly Reichert, whose almost saintly integrity has won her worldwide critical acclaim, but left her largely unknown to the public. Ever since her 1994 debut, River of Grass, this 52-year-old filmmaker has developed a stripped-down vision uniquely her own, one that asks you to give yourself over to her quiet restraint and unhurried rhythm. Her latest film, Certain Women, is one of her finest. Based on short stories by Miley Malloy, it tells the loosely interlinked tales of three women in small-town Montana, where the air is chill and the skies are gray. In the first, the great Laura Dern plays a lawyer with a slippery boyfriend. She's having trouble with a blue-collar client, that's Jared Harris, who wants something more heartfelt from her than legal advice. In the second, Michelle Williams shines as a does-everything wife with a slippery husband and a sulky daughter who focuses her bristling energy onto getting authentic local sandstone for a new house. These rather wispy stories set us up for the third and richest one, which centers on a moving turn by newcomer Lily Gladstone. She plays a lonely Native American ranch hand who stumbles across a night class taught by a badly dressed young lawyer, Beth Travis, superbly played by Kristen Stewart, who must drive 4 hours each way to teach it. Quickly developing a crush, she takes Beth to the local diner, and these two awkward women develop a bond whose fragility will become agonizing to watch. Here, she asks Stewart's lawyer why she once mentioned she feared that she might wind up selling shoes.
Why were you afraid of selling shoes?
Have you ever sold shoes?
I mean, why were you afraid you couldn't get anything else?
I don't know, because my mom works in a school cafeteria, my sister in a hospital laundry, so selling shoes is the nicest job a girl from my family is supposed to get.
Now, in some ways, Reichert's work is most startling for what it refuses to be. Where Hollywood likes big, easy-to-market storylines, her films are almost like haikus. Two friends take a seemingly uneventful camping trip in Old Joy. A drifter searches for her missing dog in Wendy and Lucy. Where Hollywood heroes are larger than life, Reichert's live marginal existences, either psychologically or materially, and often have no clear idea what to do. Where Hollywood specializes in punchy dialogue, her characters are so laconic or inarticulate that they make the yup, nope cowboys of yore seem positively garrulous. And have I mentioned that she's fascinated by female stoicism? In fact, Reichert is tuned to precisely the thing that most movies cut out, the largely undramatic texture of daily life. She pays rapt attention to silences. She lingers over small, private moments charged with ambivalence, yearning, or fleeting joy. And she captures how her characters fit into the vast, sometimes overwhelming landscape of the American frontier. As in her feminist Western, Meek's Cutoff, the most realistic film I've ever seen about the crushing rigors of crossing America in a wagon train. You find all of this and more in Certain Women, whose heroines, all tremendously well acted, are marked by their bottled-up uncertainty. Should Dern's good-hearted lawyer be warmer to her troubled client, even though he doesn't trust her legal advice because she's a woman? Will Williams' wife really find satisfaction when she finally gets that sandstone? Or is she actually building herself a prison? And what does the yearning, big-hearted ranch hand learn from an affection for Beth that she knows is impossible? These are the kinds of questions that can't be answered by the usual movie methods. Cape Crusaders, psychodrama showdowns, miraculous plot twists. They must be approached with the same patience and care that Reichert brings to her filmmaking. Her movies are all about noticing small things to discover the enormous things within. This doesn't happen quickly, but like life itself, her work has a way of sneaking up on you.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Our next guests are the creators of HBO's futuristic series Westworld. It's set in a theme park inspired by movie westerns in which wealthy tourists come to act out their western fantasies. Those fantasies usually involve shootouts, showdowns, fistfights, and sex. Since the visitors can't shoot real people, they enact their fantasies with lifelike androids. After an android is shot, it's repaired and has its memory wiped. But there seems to be a glitch in the android's new software update, and some of them are behaving strangely, perhaps even gaining consciousness. Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy adapted Westworld from a 1973 film of the same name, which was written and directed by Michael Crichton. Nolan and Joy are married. This is their first time working together. Jonathan Nolan, who goes by the name Jonah, has written movies with his brother Christopher Nolan, including Interstellar, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises. Lisa Joy has written for the TV shows Burn Notice and Pushing Daisies. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip from the first episode of Westworld. An android, who's being programmed to be a rancher's daughter named Dolores, has been put into a diagnostic dream state by the park's head of programming, played by Jeffrey Wright. The android is played by Evan Rachel Wood.
Bring her back online. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling quite myself.
You can lose the accent. Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
That's right, Dolores. You're in a dream. Would you like to wake up from this dream?
Yes. I'm terrified.
There's nothing to be afraid of, Dolores. As long as you answer my questions correctly. Understand?
Yes.
Good. First, have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
No.
Tell us what you think of your world.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Morning, Daddy. You sleep well?
Well enough. You headed out to set down some of this natural splendor?
Thought I might.
To believe there is an order to our days, a purpose.
Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thanks. Lovely to be here.
So, had either of you seen the original movie or its sequel, Future World, before that?
Lisa hadn't. I had when I was a kid, and I still have nightly panics about Yul Brynner's character in that film.
The gunslinger.
The gunslinger, indeed. I had two older brothers, so I was exposed to films that were a little too scary for my age. I was a kid growing up in England. I had been very struck by that film, by its sort of relentless world-building quality. You know, Crichton had this amazing gift to sort of peer into the future and see what our technologies would enable for us. And here with Westworld, he was anticipating not just AI, not just robots, which is a topic that I've been tackled before, but robots very specifically in this position of servicing our fantasies. He was anticipating what we now call open-world gaming or sandbox gaming. Video games, which barely existed when Crichton was writing the original film, we've almost fully realized the world that he imagined. If you look at Grand Theft Auto or many of the games that have been built with similar characteristics.
A lot of the players in your show, the guests, you know, they go to this park because they can kill androids, they can have sex with androids, and basically just act as immorally as they want because they have no risks, there's no consequences to their action. They can't be killed, and all the robots are programmed, as you said, to serve their needs. And the guests, you know, they behave terribly. And, you know, these androids are meant to look as human as possible. They're bleeding. They're completely terrified. But the guests don't seem to mind because they're androids. I mean, one guest at one point, there's a scene there inside a saloon, and he just blows up the entire place, and he says, well, that's a bleeping vacation. I mean, it's a pretty pessimistic view of human nature.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think in that example and in these are people who are looking for the dark thrills of the park. And frankly, it's most video games, when people play them, they play for similar thrills. There are very few video games where they're like completely pacifistic. And if there are, I tend to play them. Dance Dance Revolution. There's a game called Flower that I really enjoy. But there's a lot of shoot 'em ups, and there's a lot of, you know, car races, and there's a lot of war games, and there's a lot of violent sports games. And there's something about that that seems to have a real appeal for certain people.
Yeah, it reminds me of like the behavior you see people sometimes at airports or, you know, in their cars or even like online where there's, you know, there's a certain anonymity and the social contract kind of goes out the window. Were you thinking about that when you were writing the show?
Absolutely. As our world becomes more cloistered and the experiences we choose for ourselves, especially in the West, we're able to design not just our environment, but also our intellectual environment to suit our preferences and predilections. We are, you know, sort of designing this odd prophylactic universe in which we can do whatever we want. You know, that implies a subclass, that implies people who service that for us. And then within our online interactions, especially, as you said, you know, the line from the way that people, we live in LA, the way people behave in their cars and the way that they behave online is strikingly similar. Lisa at one point bought me an Xbox, and I remember when the Xbox Live service went on, the magic of being able to play games and then hear other players. You could hear them in your headset. Mm-hmm. And that magic lasted about 30 seconds until you realized that the things that the other players had to say to you were shockingly offensive.
So you took the headphones off?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So as the show progresses, some of the androids seem to becoming more self-aware. This seems to be due to like a software update that allows them access to memories. Before that, their memories would get wiped out after traumatic experiences or after they'd sort of gotten to the end of their storyline. But as they access more and more memories, they seem to be gaining the beginnings of some sort of consciousness. When you were sitting down to write the show, did you have to say like, okay, what does self-aware artificial intelligence look like?
Absolutely. So we had to strike a balance in terms of performance, because what we realized once we'd shot the pilot and we were cutting it, working with this incredible cast, Evan Rachel Wood and Tandy Newton and James Marsden and the other hosts articulating in their performance, we could impact it a little bit in terms of which takes we used, and then also using visual effects to manipulate the performance, to slow down the way their eyes move, to slow down some of their responses. What we found was that if we made them seem too less than conscious, if we dulled that light to a point where you started to step into that uncanny space, the audience lost sympathy for the host. Humans are incredible in terms of their ability to extend empathy and their ability to take it away. And so if we took Evan's performance and dialed out a little bit of the light in her eyes or a little bit of the movement in her facial muscles or her response time, you literally stop caring about the characters.
There's a lot of violence in the show. And early in the first episode, there's an implied rape that happens off screen. Yeah, and I think that the show can kind of be seen as like a critique of how the entertainment industry uses violence and sex and sexual violence to entice viewership. And, you know, your show, by having people who write storylines and people who enact them and guests who enjoy them, it seems to be putting the blame on lots of sides there. Was that critique one of the reasons why you wanted to make the show?
Yeah, there is a lot of violence in the show. But I think it is trying to be critical on a level of why is it that we enjoy these things in our film and television, in the novels that we read. Universally, there are a handful of films that you can point to every year that don't feature some transgressive behavior, some crime, some violence. The question that we're asking with the series, in part, because it's the question the hosts will begin to ask as they begin to understand their situation, is what is wrong with us? Why do we enjoy watching these things?
Well, I'd like to play a clip from episode 2 that kind of gets to some of these issues. The main writer of the park's storylines, Lee Sizemore, was played by Simon Quarterman. He's presenting his newest narrative for the park. And we'll also hear Anthony Hopkins, who plays Robert Ford, who co-created the park and is going to weigh in on the presentation. So let's hear that.
This storyline will make Hieronymus Bosch look like he was doodling kittens. I have vivisection, self-cannibalism, a special little something I call the Horroborus. Now, I don't want to appear immodest, but this is the apex of what the park can provide. Our most skilled guests will fight their ways to the outer limits of the park, besting fearsome braves, seducing newborn maidens, befriending tragically ill-fated sidekicks, And, of course, like all our best narratives over the years, our guests will have the privilege of getting to know the character they're most interested in, themselves. I present our guest's next obsession, Odyssey on Red River.
No.
Sorry?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think...
What is the point of it? You got a couple of cheap thrills, some surprises, but it's not enough. It's not about giving the guests what you think they want, but that simple. Titillation, horror, elation. They're parlor tricks. The guests don't return for the obvious things we do, the garish things. They come back because of the subtleties, the details.
Well, first of all, I have to say, you're not generously depicting writers in that scene.
Yeah, we're hastening to point out that Simon's character, Lee, is not based on any writer that we may know.
No, of course not.
With.
Never. Jonah, you've also written screenplays with your brother, Christopher Nolan. You wrote the two Batman movies, The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, as well as Interstellar. How do you compare writing with your brother to writing with your wife?
I'm sitting right across from him.
She won't hear.
A couple of key distinctions. I working with Chris over the years is a fantastic experience, and I'm very proud of the movies that we worked on together. I would typically be working on the next film while Chris was shooting the last one. I think that was one of the great benefits of that relationship for Chris, was that I was able to sort of get out in front of it. In particular on The Dark Knight, Chris was off shooting The Prestige, and I was sort of tasked with, okay, here's an idea. You know, we'd worked together on Batman Begins. I'd worked on that film for a few months, so I knew the characters well. But it's a solitary existence, feature writing. Mm. And I was looking at Lisa's experience in television and realizing how collaborative it was, that great, terrible thing of the writer's room where, you know, you can build a kind of a collective consciousness. And on days when you're not feeling terribly inspired, the room can pick you up and carry you forward. Here, the opportunity to collaborate with Lisa was a parallel collaboration. And for me, as an opportunity to direct, which is be able to engage with the material, not just at the script stage, but then directly with the actors, with the designers, and all of the amazing crew that we put together.
Lisa, I read that you didn't watch TV or movies until you were 23. Is that right?
You know, I watched some, you know, if I was homesick from school or something, but I'm the child of a tiger mom. Is that the parlance for it now? You know, both my parents aren't really from this country, and the emphasis was really on education and studying, and TV seemed like it was not the best use of my time for my parents. So ironically, of course, I rebelled completely, and now it's how I make a living.
Yeah, what do they think about that?
Well, you know, I used to be a lawyer, and my mom, when I first got my first writing job, she said, well, can you just do it at night and keep doing law during the day? And so they were a little worried, as you would be, I think, as any parent is, if their child says, hey, I'm going to leave my job with health insurance and a happy future laid out and enter this crazy world where you're making up stories. But
A few months after you got your first job, we both went on strike.
Yeah, we both went on writer's strike. So we were both doubly unemployed. That must have given them a heart attack. But, you know, they've been incredibly, incredibly supportive. And I'm so grateful, too, because in never assuming that I would be able to be a professional writer, you know, I had so many other experiences. And also, I renew my bar membership every year. So if this all goes horribly wrong, right, I can still defend you in a court of law.
So there's a great saloon heist scene in the first episode that's using as the score for it the Rolling Stones song Paint It Black. And the music starts out as a role for a player piano. And the player piano throughout the show seems to sort of be a visual stand-in for the androids. But as the scene progresses, it evolves in this beautiful orchestral arrangement that's like sounds like Western. There's some like bolero. It's such a well-scored scene. Can you talk about the music there?
we couldn't resist the symbol of the player piano as the sort of the first robot of the West. It felt like the best possible sort of symbol for our host, you know, things that are pre-programmed to evoke an emotional response. So we were able to play with contemporary music. All of it is then rearranged. In the case of Painted Black, it then evolves into an orchestral score using strings. It's a wonderful thing to be able to play with in this context, as the audience's emotional, pre-existing emotional relationship with some of these songs, and we take full advantage of it throughout the season.
Well, Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for Westworld. It's really terrific.
Thank you. It was so lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Sam.
Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy created and write the HBO series Westworld. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
I gotta get back to Father.
Dolores, no!
Don't mind me. Just trying to look chivalrous.
Oh, Teddy.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Ganny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.